Good afternoon, everybody. Good morning for those of you still on the West Coast, calling in from the West Coast. My name is Carlos Pichon, and we're here for the Brownfields Roadmap webinar. We have a very good turnout, both on phone lines and on the streaming audio. The usual protocol, I'm sure many of you have been on these webinars before. If you are on the phone line, please remember to press star 6 to mute your button. To unmute, you can press pound 6 when we have questions and answers. You should all be on page 1 of the slides. You'll see it's got the Kluwen banner across the top, and there's a picture of the cover of the Brownfields Roadmap. So my name, again, is Carlos Pichon. I'm with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. And let me just give you some background on the webinar before we go through the logistics once more. I introduce the speakers and hand it over to the first speaker, Megan Quinn. So this webinar was produced to provide insight on the structure and content of the Brownfields Roadmap through understanding options for site investigation and cleanup. As its title suggests, this is the fifth edition. Give you a bit of background on where we have come from. The roadmap has information for several key audiences, the Brownfields investigation and cleanup world. Notice that all are registered in today's webinar, including Brownfield grant recipients, local governments, development agencies, environmental consulting firms, large and small, state regulators, and of course the municipalities, as well as some colleagues of mine from EPA, both in headquarters and in the region. So we're glad to have a sellout for this webinar. We hope that we meet your expectations as far as content, et cetera. So as you know, the navigation buttons across the top of the screen, we're going to move on to slide number 2. This is the classic housekeeping slide. Being quiet phone lines, and that's appreciated. It can tell the experience of folks being on these webinars. But as a quick reminder, you may hit star 6 to mute your phones, and pound 6 to unmute when we have question and answer. Now, to move through the slides, the speakers, we will be calling out the slide number as we move forward, so that's always a cue for you to do that, and you'll notice the page numbers are on the lower left-hand side. At any point, you can press the question mark button, and that will send us a little note. You type your question, and I'll have those on hand to ask those questions of the speakers. Additionally, if you are on the phone line, you may ask a question at any point during the Q&A question and answer portions of the webinar. So with that, please go to slide number 3. I'd like to do some quick introductions and review of the agenda. There you have the topics and who the speaker will be. Again, I'm Carlos Pichon. I'm with the Senior Environmental Protection Specialist here in EPA. I manage the Brownfields Land Revitalization Technology Support Center, and my involvement in this effort, including leading the production of the Brownfields Roadmap. So I'll be doing introductions, master ceremonies in a sense, and also providing you an overview of the roadmap. But immediately after me now, talking about relevance for EPA grant recipients and applicants of this presentation, we'll have Megan Quinn of the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, where she's been for 6 years. Megan currently manages the National Revolving Loan Fund Program, the National Multipurpose Pilot Program, and the National Assessment and Cleanup Program. She definitely has her hands full. Megan graduated from Indiana University with a BA in Political Science and holds a master's degree in Public Administration from American University in Washington, D.C. I introduced myself just a minute ago. And after I give you an overview of the roadmap, you'll be hearing from Ignacio Bairik, who is the director of the Center for Creative Land Recycling, also known as CCLR, CCLR. Ignacio coordinates CCLR's technical assistance program for redevelopment projects. He is a redevelopment expert, having spent 21 years with the city of Emeryville in California, redevelopment agency, where he was responsible for the city's brownfields program and was instrumental in Emeryville's redevelopment of hundreds of acres of land. At this point, I hand the mic, the virtual mic, over to Megan Quinn, brownfields program.
Thanks, Carlos, and hi, everyone. As Carlos said, my name is Megan Quinn, and I work in the brownfields office at here at EPA. Manage a lot of the grant programs here, as well as a lot of our major competitions. So I just wanted to quickly talk about what the relevance for this particular roadmap would be for this audience. You know, really, we look at this roadmap in the Brownfields program. I appreciate so much the partnership we have with the Superfund program to be able to put something like this together, because it's a great help for communities. And we really see that this roadmap provides tools for that's really its relevance.
And Carlos, if you could hold a second and see if we can stop that noise. Okay, please continue.
Okay, thanks. I didn't even realize that was going so loud. So we thought that this would be particularly helpful to a couple groups, obviously to new grantees. We're thinking of those that you may have just received your funding a few days ago, our new fiscal year 2012 grantees. But we also think that this roadmap can offer ideas for potential applicants and communities without our funding that are trying to address their brownfields in different ways. I did want to talk about the second bullet here just to give you an idea about a few of our programs. Our big one, the assessment and our cleanup grant program, that's probably the one that's most familiar to folks. We do, $60 to $70 million a year we give out to communities in those two groups. We did 219 grants last year for about $60 million. You know, for our assessment grants, those are $200,000. They're community-wide or site-specific. If you're using a community-wide assessment grant, it's allowing address multiple sites, and we think the roadmap relevance for those assessment grantees is really the roadmap helps you think about possible courses of action that can happen after you do the assessments or you get those reports back. For cleanup grants, these are our second most popular grant. Those are $200,000 apiece. These are site-specific, so they're usually the seed money. We know that $200,000 isn't normally going to clean up many of the brownfields in your communities, but we look at it as seed money to get you started in the right direction. And we think the roadmap is really relevant to this group because, you know, you need to understand a lot of the cleanup regulations, how to engage your community, of course, that goes with both the assessment and the cleanup, and just what steps to follow and when, because cleanup can be a really complicated thing, especially when you're working with your state voluntary response programs. So we really see the relevance there for the cleanup grants. That next bullet, targeted brownfields assessments, these are, we do about $5 million in TBAs a year, targeted brownfields assessments. And these are non-competitive. They're EPA-provided and contractor-led, but we still see the roadmap as a great help for recipients of these TBAs because it's still helping you to interpret the results that you receive from that TBA and steps for moving forward, whether it's in applying for one of our grants, moving towards cleanup, or discovering that not much cleanup is needed. And then finally, our state and tribal response programs are also big champions of this roadmap. We do about $50 million a year, and that's through an allocation to our state and tribal partners. There's about 94 tribes last year that received funding, 50 states and 4 territories. And I know that the state and tribal folks really use this roadmap in an outreach for their communities. So we think that that is a great help, and hopefully you'll find this presentation helpful for you guys as you start performing outreach to your communities on our next round of grants. So anyway, you'll see our web link there. It's epa.gov/brownfields. And you can go and visit that website, and I'll have all sorts of information, including a lot more information on our grants. Next slide, slide 5. And that brings me to some very important links and some very important dates. Our FY13 assessment, RLF, and cleanup grant guidelines are now out. They were posted a couple weeks ago on our website, and proposals are due November 19th. So, you know, you have just about a month and a half left to pull those proposals together, and I'm sure a lot of stuff we talk about today you can take back and apply to your proposals. The second important date there, that second bullet, is our FY13 area-wide planning grants. Those guidelines have also been posted. Those proposals are due November 30th. We did this for the first time as a pilot 2 years ago, and it was very successful, and we're doing it again. These are not for assessment or cleanup of sites, but instead are for looking at a group of brownfields or a corridor or what have you, and putting together a master plan or some sort of plan to address those brownfields in your community. And finally, maybe the most important dates of all, our annual national brown, semi-annual National Brownfields Conference is coming up in Atlanta, May 15th through 17th of next year, and registration is open. So if you go and visit that link, brownfieldsconference.org, go ahead and register. There is a fee this year for the first time, and it'll give you all the details online, but registration is now open, and we're looking forward to a great conference down in Atlanta. So, Carlos, I think that's it.
Someone needs to mute his phone.
Yes, thanks for that request. I appreciate it. And we're sorry about the audio quality. I see the notes that are coming in on the question area. So our folks over in our tech support are currently troubleshooting it to see if it's either the feeder that's sending the streaming audio out or where the where that problem is coming from. We understand basically that it's a very low. It's completely faded. So we're troubleshooting that while we speak. Hopefully it'll be resolved shortly, and we are tracking your questions to see that that improves. So sorry about that. Well, thank you very much, Megan, for those updates from the Brownfield program. If we can now move to the next slide. Let's see. Let me get back there. We are on slide number 5. And I wanted to briefly mention the topics that I'll be covering in the next few minutes. I want to briefly describe who our target audiences are, and this is important because for folks to understand in what context this roadmap is prepared and the information we're sharing, who we're trying to reach. I'll also summarize the theme of the fifth edition of the roadmap, which is this concept of back to basics. And I'll also cover chapter one of the roadmap before I hand it over to Ignacio. Okay, so the roadmap is intended to be useful for relatively broad a series of stakeholders, but primarily new folks who may have a certain degree less experience in managing a site, and it introduces general concepts and methods. It's not that we've eliminated. Please remember to keep your phones on mute. That'd be much appreciated. Otherwise, we'll try to identify the lines and drop them. Thank you.
So it's not that we have dropped more detailed information than we had in previous editions, but we've expanded to include some back-to-basic concepts. The decision-makers, this information is relevant to decision-makers looking for detailed information on the applicability and technologies and resources to help make decisions. At the core, that is what the roadmap was developed for, but we'll see how that has evolved over time. And it presents best management practices that indeed have been emerging and evolving over time. Another target audience are definitely stakeholders who hire and oversee site cleanup professionals. It helps information, the roadmap includes information to help coordinate those with cleanup practitioners. And of course, it also includes information about the Brownfields program, although we try to minimize that because, of course, that is available at in OBLR, in the Brownfields program itself. There are, we do have content that's relevant to other stakeholders, including, for example, financial institutions who may be assessing and minimizing the risk associated with a redevelopment. So let's go to slide number 6, please. I'm sorry, moving on to slide number 7. This is where I wanted to talk about this new focus of the 5th edition and a new section and that's in the front part. In the late 1990s, when we first released a roadmap, what was the first edition back then, there were rapid developments in the field of sampling and analytical technologies. And the focus of that original roadmap, which, by the way, all 5 roadmaps are available on the website where you downloaded this one. Back then, there were rapid developments in field sampling and analytical technologies. And the focus of the roadmap was on the application of those innovative technologies, both site characterization, sampling, site characterization, and remediation in the brownfields environment. Back then, the roadmap was old quote unquote paper, and it was quite a large document. So that first edition outlined the brownfields program cleanup process and introduced the advantages of innovative technologies and asked the key questions at each phase. Over the years, we have been evolving those key questions. We have been building on them and expanding on them. So the second edition came out in 1999. It expanded to include new resources. It had a bit more targeted information for stakeholders to make the decision. However, we received feedback from readers that suggested that the information we had on innovative and new technologies, both in characterization and remediation, needed to be in the context, more in the context of a brownfield site cleanup. Because a lot of that information, admittedly, was generated for the Superfund program, for the context, Superfund program context. In 1999, we did come out with great innovation as far as dissemination was that we came out with a CD-ROM. We were pretty proud of that back then, and that allowed us to slim down the document. In 2001, we came out with the third edition of the roadmap. It was developed for an expanded audience, and for the first time, it provided the spotlights that related to the use of innovative technologies. One highlight for the 2001 edition is that we did include a Spanish edition. And this was the last time we produced them with a quote-unquote with a CD-ROM version. We have not updated the Spanish version since then due to budget constraints. In 2005, we produced the fourth edition. It reflected what was relatively new back then, the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act. For the first time, it provided a detailed guide to to typical contaminants found at brownfield sites, and it had the first time full online version. So here we are with the fifth edition, the back to the basics theme. Our goal here is to help non-technical stakeholders understand the process of assessing cleanup in brownfield sites. That's still the goal from the first one. But it focuses on concepts, strategies, and methods to prepare sites for reuse, and that's that section I'll talk about in just a minute. It introduces a range of considerations and activities for each phase
Upper Banfield's project and uses independent spotlights to provide an overview of specific technical and policy issues, best practices, and innovative approaches to site assessment and cleanup. And in today's webinar, we will be highlighting a few of those spotlights and some of the key points associated with them. So, if we please navigate to slide number 8. So here on this simple slide, we present the three main formats associated with this fifth edition. There is a publication on the left-hand side of which there's both a PDF option and a paper copy. A paper copy can be ordered of that document. It's a 42-page document. There's also the roadmap itself, which is available both in the PDF document as well as online. And finally, we have on the right-hand side what is the website, and a lot of the deep content and external and related resources, all in a link, are available on the Brownfields Roadmap website. So we've realigned the roadmap and attempted to make it more simpler, less complicated to use. It more clearly identifies critical questions to be asked and answered, and what information can be used to help answer those questions. In the publication itself, the PDF/print copy is much shorter, with more emphasis on understanding options and considerations. As I mentioned, the key resources are highlighted in the publication, while the companion website provides direct access to those resources. So hopefully, will help you see the types of questions that can be asked and how all the information available to address those questions is interlinked through these three media platforms. Okay, so if we could go to slide number 9, please. So based on the experience that we have in our office providing technical assistance at projects, again, that's both in the Superfund program as well as the Brownfield and other projects, and hearing feedback we received on the previous editions of the roadmap, on those earlier early drafts of the fifth edition, we added a section on key considerations that are best tackled before getting, quote-unquote, in the field. Now, we're not suggesting that these considerations need to be answered before we get out in the field, but certainly that they be considered so that decisions made subsequently are in consideration of those key considerations. Some of these examples include setting reuse goals and planning. These help define decisions throughout the project and what we need to know about those decisions. Understanding regulatory guidelines, and liability concerns, for example, influences how uncertainty in the endpoint can affect our cleanup decisions. Engaging the community, identifying funding, and seeking professional support are other topics, and we recognize that we can't cover all of these in the roadmap, but we do highlight some of the key questions, and we are expanding other resources associated with it. For example, in seeking professional support, at the end we'll briefly mention that we are preparing a contracting primer for the Brownfield audiences, particularly for grantees, to more effectively leverage the contracting process to secure innovative approaches to site characterization and cleanup. Two spotlights related to this topic are EPA's redevelopment initiatives to more efficiently and collaboratively prepare contaminated sites for reuse, and the spotlight on EPA's efforts to support tribal revitalization. So that, let's go to slide number 10, please. So I wanted to highlight some of the, show you some of the highlights of the roadmap website itself. The first point I wanted to mention is, I suggested earlier, is the access to download or order a hard copy of the 40-page Brownfields document itself. if you order the, if you download the PDF and you have it online, all links are live. You can click through it. But URLs are also available. So there are four entry points, to the more technical content. That little triangle you see there, the deeper information in the site can be accessed either starting, with questions about the site, the type of site, the contaminant that we expect is there, the site investigation technology, or the remediation technology. And we'll go through those in just a second. The roadmap itself can be navigated through the clickable roadmap. On the lower left-hand side, there's a little picture there. You had a larger one earlier. And that's, at the core, that's what the roadmap's about. It walks us through the whole process, and at each point, it identifies key decisions, key questions, and associated resources. Now, that roadmap itself, the whole thing is clickable. It's one large, it fills a full screen, if that's your preferred navigation option, and it allows you to access all the information associated with the different questions that we may be asking throughout the process. For the online version, there are links to approximately 300 associated resources, associated with some of those questions. We don't only provide a listing of those documents, they're also peppered throughout the roadmap, co-located with a topic where they would be most relevant. So, for example, in the document, chapters, and the spotlights, etc. There are also access, as I mentioned, through the clickable roadmap, and they can also be accessed through the contaminant and technology guide, which are those three triangles I just mentioned. Let's go to that slide now. It's slide number 11. So this is the online guide to contaminants and technologies, which was first produced with the previous edition, with the fourth edition of the roadmap, and it presents the range of technologies for investigation and remediation contaminants found at typical brownfield sites. It provides navigation options to help users find details based on what is currently known about their site. Allows you to find information about specific site types, identify contaminants that are likely associated with those sites, and learn what technologies can be used to investigate and treat contaminants at those sites. As you click through, it links to related publications and resources. Now, of course, you would access any one of these four entry points, site type, investigation technologies, treatment technologies, or contaminant group, depending on the information you have on hand. Now, we certainly don't claim that this is an expert system, and it's never a substitute for qualified professionals, but it does help our target audiences to be better informed, ask the right questions, and better understand the information that they are receiving. As an example, we'll click through the site without actually clicking, but let's go to slide number 12. And we will start with site types and walk through a very quick example. So now we are on the site types page. We would have clicked on site types on that earlier triangle that you saw. And on the lower right-hand side is a screenshot of what we would see. On the web, we'd see a list of site types. You can see on the left-hand side there, agricultural, battery recycling, chemical dye manufacturing, etc. And across the top are the most common contaminants associated with that site. So that's that first relationship between site history and contaminants that one might expect to cite. Now, both the site type and the contaminant groups are clickable. In other words, we can click either on the x-axis or the y-axis. To illustrate what we'd find by doing this, we're going to go ahead and click on dry cleaning. So you see it's one of the site types we have here. We have that little circle around it,
And if we just click on that, we can go to slide 13, and we'll see what we get. So having clicked on dry cleaners, we'd see that the whitish screen we have that's on the upper right-hand side, site type dry cleaning. And we land on a page that compiles information on typical contaminants, investigation technologies for these contaminants, and treatment technologies for these contaminants. For example, if we were to click on treatment technologies, we'd get that screen on the lower right-hand side. And we could select air sparging as an example for more details on information associated with that option for our site. So under the air sparging site, which we will land on after clicking on that, we have two main things to highlight. First is a description of the technology. The second is how closing the loop on navigation for the site. So if you notice, we've got that site type, we've got that technology, and we can see what other types of sites that technology is applicable to. So this is just an indication if we entered through treatment technologies and we clicked on air sparging, this is what we would see, and this is what would send us back to the site type. So this is just to show you how these are all interlinked. Now, the purpose of the roadmap is to bring all this information together or facilitate navigating to all this information. It doesn't necessarily put it all in one place. That would be a huge undertaking, but it does provide that direct link to it. So in this case, if we click on additional information, it takes us out to the CLUIN website where externally the agency maintains detailed information on air sparging, its application, case studies, etc. So that's what I wanted to provide you with as far as the background on the roadmap, where it came from, what the focus is now, what that new section is, and to provide some insight on the depth of information that's available on the website and how it can be accessed and navigated through the roadmap, the PDF, and the website. So on slide 15, of course, I take the opportunity to put a little bit of a plug for the home of the roadmap, the Brownfields and Land Revitalization Technology Support Center, invite you to take a look and browse through that, to save it on your favorites. You may request technical assistance, download all the documents that we've talked about here, navigate, etc. And if we go to slide 16, we want to get deeper into those key questions, the four core chapters of the roadmap. And that's what we have to do that. The Brownfields roadmap itself, it's one click away from the homepage. And of course, from your experience, you probably know that Brownfields site assessment and cleanup is not a straight path. There are many detours and U-turns depending on the site and the project. This version of the roadmap has evolved from the four previous editions. And right now, we think we've included almost all the possible routes you could follow and what relevant questions you'd ask at each point and what key questions you would ask, particularly at those main phases of assessing the site, investigating the site, assess and select cleanup options, and design and implement the cleanup. Those are the four core chapters of the roadmap, and I'm going to hand it over to Ignacio now, who's going to do us a walkthrough of those sections and share some of his insights. Ignacio?
Yes, thank you, Carlos. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Actually, I just got a suggestion that are there any questions at this point for a quick clarification on what's been covered so far? Okay, I'll check the I haven't had a chance to check the online questions. I'll do that now, and I'll get to them after Ignacio's part. So, Ignacio, thank you.
All right, thank you, and good afternoon, folks. I'm with the Center for Creative Land Recycling. We're one of the TAB technical assistants to Brownfields grantees of the EPA, and we provide that assistance to local government, state government, and nonprofits in regions 8, 9, and 10, which is basically the Dakotas west to Guam. And just so disclosure is that while I've used the roadmap before, I'm pretty new to it, and unlike my EPA colleagues, I was not involved in the development of it. And I can tell you that there is so much information here that I can only really hit some high points in these four blue squares that you see in rectangles you see in front of you, and how they relate to a redevelopment of a brownfield site. And so it's called a roadmap, but it's really more of a GPS, and you know, you can make a wrong turn, and GPS will set you on the right direction. And another thing that I did see in the roadmap, which is really key here, is, you know, there's a roadmap, and we need drivers. And for a very contaminated site like a Superfund site, that would be a case where the regulatory agency or maybe the health agency is the driving. They're driving this vehicle through this map. You go through pretty much the same process, but they drive the schedule. In a brownfields context, that could be the developer, the community, the local government, and you're all in the car together, as it were. And so another thing to consider is that there are a lot of states and international callers in on the line. So the framework technology standpoint is pretty much the same, but this will vary based on your local regulations. For instance, in some countries, they don't even have a regulatory agency that regulates toxics. So these are all things to consider. So I'm going to the next slide now. I did go through this already. So let's go to slide 18. When assessing the site, this is where
I'm sorry. I just get to mute my phone.
I'm sorry, your phone is not muted. Please mute your phones. Thank you.
Yes, I'm at slide 18 now, assess the site.
Aperture again. What it was is that it had been, it wasn't on default.
Hello, please make sure your phones are muted. We can hear a conversation. That's much appreciated. Please mute your phones. Thank you.
It's a library. Where it was in pictures.
Under assess the site, this is where basically you start thinking about your environmental site assessment, the phase one. And even before you dive into a phase one, it's important to look at the site and its surroundings. You look at the neighborhood. You start thinking about your consultant team. Is there a city, the team members in the city, the planning department, the economic development?
What
expectations you have on the site?
I couldn't see it. I clicked on the icon of the WD.
I think we still can hear someone speaking there.
Let's a minute of silence.
Still things that are going on with it.
Hello, I don't know what's going on, but could you please put your phone on mute? Hello? Could you please put your phone on mute?
And I can open them at my office.
You're not aware. I'm calling our tech support, seeing if they can mute all the lines except for yours.
All right.
Please excuse that interruption, but we're going to proceed.
It's a PC.
Hey, Nacho, please proceed. Just have to raise your voice a little bit. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay. And so, again, before even proceeding with the phase one, is there any been...
I have to be able to
plans discussed for the site, the land use, and actually even pre-development uses, any historic uses, what the geology is, archaeology, and it's also time to look for money. Also consider the building, maybe there's lead and asbestos, and maybe any emissions that have been generated from the site. So these are all things to consider even before starting a phase one. As far as the team is concerned, so to go to slide, okay, I'm on slide 19 now. Yeah, slide 19. The team members could include your lawyers, planners, consultants, developers, and you know, there are quite a few things really to look at when just starting out and what your goals are for the site. At this point, you may be thinking, is it time to contact, get the community involved or not? And this would be a case-by-case basis. In some instances, when a developer is involved, they want to keep things quiet until they have a development proposal. In many cases, if the site is a brownfield and there hasn't been a history of releases, it's appropriate to keep quiet. But if it's a site that has had previous releases and maybe there have been some incidents on the site, that's something to consider whether it's proper to disclose that a phase one is being conducted. But in any case, as part of a phase one, you have to interview previous owners, previous operators. So if the word's going to leak out that some investigation is going on. One other thing to consider is a site access and site control. You may not be able to do all the activities that are required of an all-appropriate inquiry phase one if you don't have site access, and this will have to be remedied at future steps in this process. For slide 20, so good upfront planning really helps prevent future problems, particularly for the budget, any legal issues, and it helps manage expectations. On a data and scientific standpoint, you might be able to realize the type of investigation you have in front of you. It may be a complex site, so you can gear up, or it may be a vanilla site with there's been lots of experience in assessing and remediating. For instance, there's already a protocol for gasoline stations. That's well known what the costs are. For other sites that are complicated, they are not. And that's also a function of the geology of the site and the density of the surrounding community. Based on what's around the site, the amount of sampling may vary. For instance, if you have a community that is very dense and there are very many residents, there may be requirements for air and dust monitoring as well. Even before cleanup starts, because you have to establish a baseline for what the air and dust is on that site. But for the most part, at this stage, unless there is a imminent endangerment to the public health and to the community, I probably would not have disclosed the results of my phase one yet. But if I did find something, then that's something to consider. Now, for the next slide, slide 21, the roadmap. Okay. Yeah, the roadmap has a lot of great resources. Grants, again, the types of sites like the dry cleaner, what an environmental site assessment is, the standards are, the technical assistance you can get. And once you see this phase one, you have to, you go through it, and you go to the executive summary, you read through it, and I go straight to the recommendations. And to anyone who's had experience reading many phase ones, the consultant will tend to take a conservative approach in recommending future action. If there is even a minutia of evidence that there could have been some contamination release, then they will recommend additional sampling. Now that you have that phase one report, the developer or the property owner, you're on notice now that you may have some RECs or recognizable environmental conditions that you would have to address. And so there are consequences if you do not follow those recommendations. And in addition, in a development standpoint also, if you are submitting, for instance, a developer is submitting a request to a planning department for a development project, the planning department would also be interested in the recommendations on the phase one, and the planning department may require additional sampling even if the property owner and the developer don't think it's necessary. So these are the kinds of things that can result from a phase one. Now, for the next slide, slide 22, we start with the site investigation. This is the point where you feel that you have to do additional sampling, actually digging, testing the soil and groundwater for contamination if it was indicated based on the initial result, initial findings. And even before you start digging, the clues for contamination would be obvious. For instance, in some cases you might have some leaking drums, in the on site. There may be peeling paint. You may have asbestos in the ceiling. There may be cracked concrete and evidence that there was heavy equipment on the site. So these are smoking guns and telltale signs that of what the kind of contamination you can expect. There may also be signs that there was a release that could be a concern for the environment and for public health. For instance, there could be a creek running through the place and evidence that some leakage may have, contamination may have made its way to the stream. So these are things where it can set up your expectations of what kind of sampling you're in for, what methods you would need to consider, and the site, the type of site it is, the scale of the sampling you would have to undertake. And these all have immediate impact on the budget. And the roadmap test, for instance, again, for a dry cleaner, it will recommend the type of sampling protocol for a dry cleaner and what to expect, the type of contamination you would find. For slide 23, so site investigation, and this is where you go into phase two, phase two means very many things, because once you start investigating a site, you may have to do several rounds of it depending on what you find. And the moment you start digging to do some sampling, that it would be wise to actually start involving your community. This is when your community member gets into the car and goes on the drive with you. In a redevelopment standpoint, you would want to know what the sampling schedule looks like and how this lines up with the project development schedule. And you don't really want the project development schedule to go far ahead of the sampling and cleanup planning, because in some sites, the cleanup drives with development. You can have on that site. In fact, I've seen many sites where the land use and redevelopment decision had to be withheld pending the results of the sampling. For the next slide, slide 24, there are many uncertainties come up is when you're starting to investigate the site, and this is where you want to determine how much sampling you have to do, how many rounds, if you can do the sampling all at one time, or if you have to go back, analyze the samples, and remobilize and sample again. And there are many technologies that help shorten this process, and there are many protocols. So, for instance, one technology suggested is a triad approach, where there's a mobile lab, and you get results instantly, and you do sampling, more sampling based on that, and you won't have to remobilize. That's, for certain sites require that kind of sampling protocol and schedule. And typically these occur in more in very complex sites or sites where there's a schedule to meet. During this process it's very important to keep the community apprised because they may have input into what into the sampling process and how they could be of value and speed up the decisions in the sampling. In many cases, the communication with the community varies. Sometimes there are websites put up, and there's up to date information on the sampling results, both soil groundwater and also for air sampling. Depending again on the site, maybe a periodic bulletin would do also, but again, this is something to consider. The next slide, slide 25. Once you have the results are in, there are many possible scenarios. Again, you might have to do more sampling. You might have to revisit the redevelopment and its objectives. There may be actions necessary to protect public health and the environment if there's a threat. So the roadmap has many resources to help determine what the next steps are. And again, the roadmap, it's good to consult with the roadmap even if you have a consultant. The roadmap has been developed by scientists, and it's road tested basically, and it's a good second source of second opinion. If you have questions for your consultant or your lawyer or your any other members of the team, it gives you enough information to ask the right questions. And at this point, you will realize what kind of contamination is involved, what type of media is involved, whether it's soil, groundwater, air, vapors. And it would be time to ask, how do you clean this up? Do you remove all of it? Or can you leave some of it behind? And if you do leave some of it behind, how do you control what's left behind and make sure that people, generations in the future know what has to be done in case, someone wants to dig it up again? These are all kinds of questions you will ask once you finish site investigation. So for the next slide, slide 26, you start choosing, the cleanup options. Hopefully you have sufficient data, and you have conducted your risk analysis. In many cases, there are several layers of risk analysis that are necessary, especially for a complicated site. And you start considering the cleanup options. It may be necessary to conduct pilot testing. For instance, there may be remedies that require, phytoremediation or bioremediation, and these require some pilot testing, and it's important to keep your community apprised of what you're planning to do for cleanup. For simple site, you can get from, the first step, assess the site, to this point very quickly. It can take a few months. But for a very complicated site, it could take years or even decades to get to this point. But once you've gotten to this point, you can start investigating the cleanup planning and the methods to clean up the site. The next slide 27. At this point, whether you have to address soil, vapor, groundwater, and in some cases reuse will drive the cleanup. In some cases, the cleanup, you have to wait for the cleanup before you can determine whether you can actually redevelop the site. And some questions to ask at this point is, again, can you remove all the contamination, or can you leave some behind? In many cases, the value of the land and future value and income from the reuse will not support a full dig and haul or a pump and treat of contamination, and that's why risk-based cleanups are considered. And in some cases also, there may be background levels that are already present that are above regulatory cleanup levels. So for instance, some sites, there may be natural occurring asbestos or arsenic, which are above cleanup levels. So all of these play into your cleanup and should be communicated to your community, especially if you're recommending cleanup levels above the thresholds that have been approved by the regulatory agency. Next slide, assess and select cleanup options, continued. The cleanup options have a big impact on the surrounding community. For this reason, there has been a focus on green cleanups, for instance, bioremediation, in situ treatment, also use of renewable energy, like solar panels in place of generators, because cleaning up a site will really involve impacts on the community as you remove contamination from the site. So there's a balance in the cleanup activities as well as the method of cleanup. And some states actually include the impact of cleanup in the risk evaluation of a cleanup method. As an example, what are the risks involved in digging up a site 30 feet versus digging up only the 5 feet and capping the site? So these are kind of risk evaluations that you might have to face when you're dealing with this type of contamination. And there will be many cases where it will be shown that you can leave a safe amount of concentrations and volume of contamination in place as long as there are effective institutional control measures in place. Slide 29. Once the remedy has been chosen, when the remedy is chosen, that usually involves a lot of public meetings. I've seen months and years of public meetings when cleanup options are being discussed and a redevelopment project is being considered, because there's an interplay between what can be developed, the cost of doing it, and the cleanup that can make it work. And there will become a point that a remedy is chosen that's been accepted by all, hopefully. And the engineers go to work now and, you know, they go and start planning this out. At this point, usually you don't hear much from the engineers anymore because at the time this is going on, the architects and the planners are probably also doing working drawings. You'll receive periodic updates, and assuming that there are no surprises from the approved cleanup, all you'll hear are the updates, and the next time you'll hear from them is when there's a community meeting to let people know that they're ready to start the project, which is cleaning up and or developing the site for redevelopment. Next slide is slide 30. This shows the typical cleanup activities, and most of these would have been planned ahead of time anyway. For instance, many planning departments and regulatory agencies would make many of these activities are contingencies of approval of a project. Now, there could be surprises along the way once you've started cleanup. For instance, there have been many discovered USTs or undiscovered underground stream or maybe archaeological artifacts. Again, these many well-planned cleanup plans already have contingencies for these, and usually they will not hold up the project unless it was not considered in the first place. And in this instance, you might have to go back into the drawing board and rethink the cleanup of the project and the reuse. Next slide, slide 31. Once the cleanup activities have been completed, and all the cleanup requirements, are met, and the cleanup is properly implemented. When you go to that question mark, was the contamination adequately removed, contained, or controlled? Hopefully the answer is a yes, and you can go for the redevelopment. When there are anticipated surprises, this would be a bump in the road, which could need more analysis or delay. It might need additional institutional control measures or additional engineering controls. Hopefully you won't have to go back and redo your cleanup plan. And in this instance, this is when environmental insurance is useful. Next slide. Once you've completed the cleanup, it's often that confirmatory sampling will be conducted, and confirmatory sampling could be take the form of basically testing the soil that's remaining, or several months or maybe years of groundwater monitoring to make sure that the cleanup measures are working. Again, there are very many complicated cleanups that you can only verify the cleanup is successful a few years after the cleanup activity actually started. Again, the roadmap has many useful resources to research on these various technologies. In addition, many states, once a site has completed its cleanup activities, they will put this into their state database, and so that people can, you know, revisit what was done on the site. All the environmental reports will be there, all the approvals will be there, and even confirmatory sampling will be included. It will also indicate whether the site is closed or conditionally closed or needs periodic monitoring. And so, you know, these are just really a few things that happen in a cleanup, in a redevelopment standpoint, and it might be daunting to the people starting out. And doing this for one site is a lot of work, and if your community has a lot of brownfields, doing it for many sites is even more daunting. And so some communities actually take some of these roadmap activities and do it on an area-wide basis, so and they have area-wide strategies. Many communities have actually done this, many area-wide cleanups. Some examples would include Milwaukee and Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, and even Emeryville took area-wide approaches, and it really facilitated the redevelopment of, of an entire area. So at slide 32, I'm going to pass it on now to the spotlight.
Ignacio, thank you very much. That was a lot of material you covered there. I really appreciate your finding the time to deliver it. Let me first ask, before I hand it off to Dan Powell to go into these spotlights he's going to highlight, if there are any questions on the phone lines for Ignacio. We have a clarification question that came in on the internet regarding the URL for the roadmap. It is on the first slide, it's on the last slide, and it's in a couple of other places, but if you want to jot it down so you have it handy, it is www.brownfieldstsc.org. So it's brownfieldstsc, that's Tango Sam Charlie, .org. Okay, so again, any questions for Ignacio? Okay, then I'll hand it off to Dan to and we're on to slide number 33. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Carlos. I'm going to try to speak loudly here because, as I understand from the folks, some of the audio problems that people were having earlier seem to have a lot to do with maybe the phone that we're using here. We've tried to clean some of those up and do the best we can. One thing I did want to note was that the recording for this session was not impacted. So if there are portions that you missed, number one, I could greatly apologize for the audio difficulty. That we do about 100-plus of these seminars per year and usually don't run into audio problems. But the recording wasn't impacted, so when the archive is complete for this session, you can listen to the audio there, the podcast of that. And again, I want to thank Carlos for all his hard work on pulling this roadmap together, and the people like Ignacio and Megan Quinn and the folks in the Brownfields office who helped pull to put this fifth edition of this document out. And I'm supposed to be talking today about the spotlight sections. And just a little background on these. We started putting the roadmap out, I believe Carlos said, back in 1999. We had three versions of this. And the third edition, we started getting enough anecdotal information either from some of the technical support sites that places where we've supported Brownfields projects or reviewed work plans, et cetera, or through conversations that we had with people, the National Brownfields Conference or at the, regional Brownfields conferences, et cetera. There was starting to become kind of a critical mass of issues that we kept hearing again and again. That were either troubling to people or that we were realizing that people needed a little bit more information on. So what we try to do is develop these spotlight sections. They're sprinkled throughout the document in the relevant sections, whether it's an assessment issue or a cleanup issue, just to give people just a little more of a description, a little more information. And also, I know there's a lot of consultants and contractors on the phone. I think it's important, too, if you're trying to explain these issues to people, it's just a nice, concise understanding of what the issue is, why it's an issue, and why you should care. And then to point you to other sources of information and who you need to talk to, et cetera. And you can see the list on the right side of slide number 32. Some of the ones. Well, I'm not going to cover all of these. We just picked out four that we thought were particularly important, and I'm going to walk through these.
So we're going 34 now.
Yeah, moving on to slide number 34, okay, I'm sorry, there's my slide copy here has a little different enumeration on it. One of the spotlights that we put out is on this concept of a project life cycle CSM or conceptual site model. I'm sure a lot of folks out there have heard the term conceptual site model, and a lot of people have different concepts of what a conceptual site model might be. And the definition we use for conceptual site model is it can either be a graphical or written summary, what's known about the site, or maybe what's hypothesized about the site. And really, it's one of the most important to us, one of the most important pieces that you can use to ensure that your cleanup is moving, your assessment and cleanup are moving in the right direction. We have seen, you know, a number of circumstances where people develop a conceptual site model as a requirement in doing their phase one or phase two assessment, and it goes into the drawer and just becomes part of the report. Now, what we're talking about here is using the conceptual site model as almost a living document that would, you know, almost a playbook to help guide you as you move throughout the process. Number one, a conceptual site model can help more fully understand what you know about the site or what you think you know about the site, what the features are. And as you know, when you clean up a site, there's many, many sources of data coming at you. There's geological data, there's chemical data, there's pathway receptor data, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea behind a conceptual site model is to kind of unify this so you can kind of look at all those different pieces of information in a unified manner. The other side of it is important. You can also identify what areas of the site that you actually understand and fully understand and understand what parts of the site you have uncertainties on, particularly those portions that are really going to affect your cleanup and reuse of the site. Why that's important, it helps you better target your investigation. Why collect a lot of information in an area where you already, you know, from past investigations or past documentations you've entered in conceptual site model, you have a really good understanding of what's happening at that particular portion of the site. Let's focus our limited resources on resolving these uncertainties where they're really important to driving the decisions at the site. And again, that's this idea. It helps you set up that plan for collecting additional information. The other side, too, here is getting some level of stakeholder agreement on site conditions and what we know about the site, what we don't, and what direction we need to move in. This is particularly important, again, when you have a lot of data that's in tables and anecdotal information and stories that people have about the site. You know, everybody has kind of a different picture of what the site might really look like. And when you start taking these different visions and putting them together into a conceptual site model, it can really be a good tool to help bring the stakeholders together. And I'll just share one example. There was a site in Colorado that we were working on through the Brownfields Tech Support Center several years back. And this particular site had really been kind of stuck in neutral, I would say, for about 11 years. And we really found that once we start, you know, it was a situation where there was contamination and there were different visions of where that contamination was coming from. Was it coming from a landfill? Was it coming from an off-site manufacturing facility, a gas station, et cetera? And when we started putting the conceptual site model together, getting some agreement on where those uncertainties lie, and then using that to drive where we were collecting samples and taking the samples, it really helped bring the folks together on that. And in a matter of a couple of years, we got the investigation underway, did the investigation, identified where the contamination was coming from, and put a remedial took remedial action at the site to get it to the point where they could redevelop this particular the natural resource. We were able to restore that natural resource. And again, a lot of it was based on the use of this conceptual site model. You can look at our Triad Resource Center. We have a section on conceptual site models, examples of conceptual site models. There's actually a Triad issue paper that talks about life cycle conceptual site models that you can find on the both the Triad Central website and also the Brownfields TSC website. We have these things co-located in numerous places because we don't want to let people figure out where these things are. We want to make sure wherever you go, you're going to find these things. So that's the idea behind the project lifecycle conceptual site model, what it is. If you go to the next slide, which I believe now is slide 35, illustrates how that conceptual site model evolves as you move through the process. You know, the idea behind a preliminary conceptual site model, let's get all that data that we know about a site. You know, there's very few sites in this country that you can't find some level of data to start putting together your preliminary understanding of what your site is. And you can also start putting in there, oh, I think there might be contamination here, I don't know, this is an important area. Or in our redevelopment, we want the building to go here, or we want the parking lot to go here, et cetera, to start to kind of piecing all that together at a very early stage of the process can help drive and make your meetings, your planning, your scoping, your spending your contract dollars much more efficient. Once you have that preliminary conceptual site model, then the idea behind it is to develop a baseline conceptual site model that will then drive your site characterization. And again, this just moves from more the kind of all appropriate inquiry type historical information, starts moving into where are the uncertainties, what exposure pathways exist, and what are the receptors, what data gaps and uncertainties exist, and which ones are important to the cleanup and reuse of the site. You know, obviously we're not trying to resolve all the uncertainties, but the ones that are important either to the from a risk perspective or from a progress perspective at the site. And then as you continue to move through from characterization to design to remediation to the post-remedy, the conceptual site model is a tool that's continually updated as you learn more about a site. And that's something that that regardless of how well you did the investigation when you first walked onto the site, as you continue to dig holes, as you continue to try to new things at the site, you're continually collecting more information and learning more information. And the idea is to add to that conceptual site model. What we've seen in a number of sites is there's not that kind of building on or handoff of the data the way it should. You have one investigation, a report's written, maybe a conceptual site model's there. Gee, that's not enough information. Let's go out and collect some more information. Or, you know, years have elapsed and we have a new consultant on board, have a new project team on board. They just do a new investigation. And, you know, may or may not be making maximum use of that existing data. So, again, it's not a technology. It's not a cleanup technology, assessment technology, or that type of thing, conceptual site model, but it's a very, very important tool to do on your cleanup. So that's our conceptual site model. Another spotlight section that we put on, if you move to slide number 36, this is vapor intrusion. We've put a spotlight in on the vapor intrusion issue. Obviously, I think some folks might be aware of this, some folks may not be aware of it, but we developed this spotlight based on some feedback that we've been getting. A number of folks have been doing assessments. They did the soil, they did the groundwater, thought they were done, and all of a sudden they realized they had a vapor intrusion issue. They may or may not have spent all their assessment dollars, and now all of a sudden they had to figure out what's going on with vapor intrusion. So we really kind of wanted to raise up the issue of what vapor intrusion was, why it's important, and we're not telling people in this spotlight how to address it or that, you know, there's considerable regulatory requirements and guidance both at the state level and the federal level, and we want to point people to those resources to understand it, but we really wanted to kind of educate people on the fact that you may be dealing with vapor intrusion. It needs to be built into your conceptual site model when you're doing your assessment from the very beginning, particularly if you think you have volatile organic compounds in the subsurface. And that's, you know, basically that's where vapor intrusion is. Toxic vapors enter structures from the subsurface contamination. You know, some examples of VOCs could be anywhere from degreasers like, you know, TCE, trichloroethylene, dry cleaning solvents, PCE, naphthalene and some other elements from wood treater sites, gasoline, and some pesticides which have volatile organic compounds as well. And again, the concept here is if you think you're dealing with these contaminations, if you have buildings and things like that that they're either existing or you're thinking about putting them in place, you really need to understand what you need to do in this vapor intrusion section. Again, moving to slide number 37, you know, just what I said, we should start evaluating vapor intrusion very early in the process, so it's not something that comes as a surprise later after we're done, or we think we're done, or moving on. And it's not a straightforward, easy thing to quantify or identify, because of, you know, the various pathways that exist and the intricacies of the subsurface. You know, you may not think you have vapor, you may have a source, you may not think you have vapor intrusion in one area and find out that it's you know, under another house or it's under a building or a structure. So it really does, you know, it is something tricky that people need to have, you know, qualified folks helping them understand how to measure it and where it should be. Again, oftentimes if you do find you have a vapor intrusion issue, there's a mitigation system, and you need to consider the fact that there's going to be operations and maintenance of that mitigation system and monitoring to make sure that you're not getting, you know, unsafe levels. And again, as I said before, states have specific vapor intrusion guidance, and, you know, these are areas where you really need to work closely with your state regulator and risk assessors, et cetera, to understand, you know, what sort of procedure you need to get in place to either identify that you have vapor intrusion issues or to disprove you have vapor intrusion issues, and if you find that you have them, you know, what to do to move forward. Moving on to slide number 38, and this just lists a few strategies. I think the strategies, you can really break it down into two areas, either, you know, number one, controlling the vapor intrusion problem within the building, and then maybe on a more tertiary standpoint, dealing with the sources of contamination that are in place that they're causing the vapor intrusion in the first place. So, again, there's the remediation aspects of it, you know, when you're using like soil vapor extraction to deal with the source itself, but then also, you know, looking at things like the building ventilation itself, you know, and the heating, the cooling systems, restricting the use of the facilities or certain parts of a facility. If you have, you know, issues there, it might be another way to look at that. And, you know, when you're in a reuse redevelopment scenario, utilizing the information or that you know to maybe understand where you may or may not put the buildings on your site. This slide lists some resources that you have out there. You have your Brownfields Technology Primer that we developed several years back. There has been a number of guidance documents that have been developed since that primer was put out, and again, this primer is not a guidance on how to deal with vapor intrusion, but it's just it is what it says. It's a primer, a primer that helps you understand what vapor intrusion is, what causes it, why you can be concerned about it, and some of the different techniques for assessment mitigation. EPA's primary website on vapor intrusion, you see the URL for that. It's on our Office of Solid Waste Emergency Response website. There's a separate section on vapor intrusion. And we have an issue area on our cleanup information website as well to deal with, that provides information, you know, additional information. Okay, moving on to slide number 39. Another spotlight is this concept of challenging cleanups. And again, what we want to do is talk about, you know, number one, just because it's a brownfield site doesn't mean you may not have to deal with it. It may not be simple, straightforward cleanup scenarios that people normally attribute to Superfund sites or federal facility sites, et cetera. You know, even a small site, whether it be gas stations or small manufacturing facilities, you know, paint shops, et cetera, you may have contaminants that are either difficult to capture, maybe difficult to separate in the media that they're in, maybe in hard to reach areas, whether it's under buildings or difficult geologic settings like in fractured bedrock. You may have contaminants that don't degrade naturally. And, you know, again, these can be at a variety of sites, whether it's gas stations, electronics, dry cleaning, electroplating, manufactured gas plant sites. They are challenging cleanups, but they're not impossible cleanups either. And, you know, in these scenarios, both the concentration of the contaminants and how they react in the subsurface and their fate and transport, et cetera, is something that really needs to be taken into account as you plan not only the cleanup but the reuse of the particular site as well. And we can't express enough how important accurate characterization is for it, particularly with for any project, but particularly when you're dealing with these difficult to understand and difficult to quantify contaminants in the environment. So understanding the behavior of the contaminants and the characterization of your site is very important. And I will point you, there is a spotlight we're not going to talk about today on high resolution characterization, which is very relevant to the next example that I'm going to use, which is on slide number 40. The concept of non-aqueous phase liquids, these don't readily dissolve in water. They only may be slightly soluble, and the bulk of the contamination remains as a source in that groundwater. Your dense non-aqueous phase liquids tend to sink. The lighter versions tend to float or start to be near the top of the water table. And they may go into multiple directions depending on the geology and the subsurface. And if you see that little graphic on the right-hand portion of your slide, those are, you know, there's cracks and fissures and less permeable, more permeable areas. They tend to kind of follow those pathways, and they can be very difficult to address. And the problem with the DNAPLs is they can be continuing sources of contamination. So even if you're cleaning up the groundwater and dealing with the portion that's in that dissolved, that is dissolved into the groundwater, you also may be dealing with, you have this continuing source, almost like the analogy I use, like a tea bag in hot water. It continues to, no matter how many times you dump the water, you still get a little bit of that in there. And even very small amounts of DNAPL in the subsurface can continue to contaminate groundwater to levels above cleanup levels. And again, we tend traditionally clean up the subsurface using pump and treat systems. But if you continue to have that source contamination in there, you're going to continue to have to pump and treat perhaps for many years. It's good to contain that dissolved contamination, and ultimately it'll probably get there, but depending on the amount that's in the subsurface, you can be doing that for a long time. And the primary ways of dealing with that, again, is various treatment technologies, getting at that source contamination. And again, the key point here is understanding where the DNAPL is in the subsurface, and really kind of, if you have this type of site, it's very important to have that high resolution type characterization to understand that source, to be able to appropriately direct your treatment of the source. Because when you use things like a thermal treatment system or oxidation, they can be expensive, remedies. And the more efficient you can be in not treating clean areas and really focusing and targeting those techniques, the more important. And then again, you can treat the dissolved plume, whether or not it's, you know, bioremediation or pump and treat. And many of the treatment technologies you can use, they do require, you know, after you do the initial treatment, some level of polishing to get to the point you want to get. And then institutional controls will also come into place. So anyway, with the DNAPL cleanups, you're going to look at some sort of source remediation and or some sort of source control to really address the problem. And then the last, I believe this is the last one, the last spotlight we're going to talk about today is the concept of institutional controls. I think a lot of folks are, you know, the Brownfields program has evolved quite a bit over the years in people's understanding of what it takes to clean up a site and what's required to move on to that reuse. But we also wanted to spotlight this concept of institutional controls, which is, you know, a broad spectrum of both administrative and legal tools. And the idea is to either minimize or eliminate exposure to contamination that might be left behind after the cleanup is complete, you know, whether it's a cap of some sort, et cetera. And then the idea is to restrict, you know, provide some level of restriction to protect the cleanup measure that might be in place. There might be a pump and treat system in place, or that's going to be running for a lot of years. Again, how do you protect that? Or a landfill cap that might be in place. How do you ensure the integrity that's not going to be somehow breached these can kind of fall into four different categories. There's proprietary controls, things like covenants and deed restrictions, government controls that restrict land use, whether that's zoning, building codes, ground use regulations, commercial fishing bans, There's more legal enforcement and permit type tools that include institutional control components. These are things like administrative orders, consent decrees, and permits. And then there's informational devices that really, you know, the kind of the misutility type activity where you provide notification and it's a place where people can find out about residual contamination that may remain in place. And this can include things like signs, it can include markers, this can include community outreach type activities. So a variety of different institutional controls that may be present at a site. Just some of the things we wanted folks to understand moving on to slide number 42 now. Long-term considerations of institutional controls. The idea behind institutional controls is there's something in place that you don't want to mess with for an extended period of time. So you do have costs associated both with administering, maintaining, and enforcing the institutional controls. The planning for implementing these controls, maintaining them, and maybe addressing enforcement challenges, either people violating institutional controls, et cetera, is something that needs to go in to your planning for reuse as you move forward with a site. And, when you're looking at these long-term costs, considerations, risks, et cetera, one of the purposes we wanted folks to understand is we really need to understand the weighing how in-depth or how long-term my institutional controls are and what those costs may be versus doing some sort of permanent treatment or removal of the contamination as well. There are some key resources that are on the roadmap website. You see the URLs there. It's several fact sheets. Beyond the Brownfields program, we have some Superfund resources as well that people may tap into. But we wanted folks to understand and be able to fully weigh when they're dealing with their cleanup plans and revitalization plans, reuse plans, you know, what the impacts of the ICs are and to consider that in their planning process. So with that, I'm going to, hopefully the audio wasn't horrendously bad like I understand it was before, and again, the apologies there. We're going to turn it back over to Carlos, and I think we're going to move on to a Q&A session here.
Yes, thank you, Dan. And I should say, I think this is going to be one of the last webinars using this current mix of technologies, which admittedly is almost 11 years old now, which is the streaming audio on the phone line. Hopefully this won't have these problems again, but sometimes new technology is not necessarily better. But anyway, let me first see if there are any questions on the phone lines for Dan or any of the previous speakers. Okay, Dan, I'll take this question on the Internet. The question is, would a conceptual site model occur before a Phase 1 ESA or only after Phase 2 IDs a definitive contaminant? Are stakeholders and the surrounding community usually involved in creating the CSM for a site?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. That was a great clarifying question. I would think you would start to assemble your conceptual site model as soon as possible, and when you're doing your Phase 1 ESA, you're collecting a lot of data, you know, that can begin the basis for putting that preliminary conceptual site model together, whether it's historical use data on a site, whether it's your plans for the site, et cetera. You can start to pull that preliminary conceptual site model together very early in the process. Then as you begin to get that definitive contaminant data, is just a quote from the question here, that's when you start to fill in and you go from that preliminary to your baseline, your characterization CSM. And then the last part of that I think is a really good point that I probably should have pulled out when I was talking about conceptual site models, is this concept that the community could be involved in that process too. I think, you know, both the community involvement in developing that, but also using the conceptual site model as a communication tool with the community. Again, when you start throwing out stacks and stacks of spreadsheets of contaminant results and tables, it's hard enough for someone who's been working at a site cleanup level for you know, doing site cleanup for 20 or 30 years to understand and get their mind around all that data. You know, people who aren't as involved in that profession, it's even harder. So having that conceptual site model is a great way to me to communicate that. I will point out that it's not just a piece of paper that you can hold up. There are a variety of visualization tools that we've been using, and I think there may be some information on that in the high resolution section, but there's a variety of visualization tools which allow you to, again, take that geologic data, the contaminant chemical data, overlay that over some of your GIS type data where you can see street grids and buildings, and it really gives people a sense, is that blob of contamination underneath my house or is underneath where we're going to put the swimming pool at, in the community center, et cetera. So it's a great tool for community engagement.
Okay, I appreciate that question. Questions on the phone lines? And questions are welcome, of course, on any of the topics that have been presented as well as the roadmap itself. If we could go to slide 44, I want to mention a couple of things while you formulate those questions. This is a URL that was asked about earlier, so brownfieldstsc.org/roadmap. That's where the roadmap itself is located. Again, this is slide 44. Also, two resources that are coming up soon from the BTSC. One is the Brownfield Grantees Roadmap to Understanding Quality Assurance Project Plans, where the document is finished. It's going through final internal review. We expect this will be very, very helpful, particularly for grantees and their project managers who are responsible for completing those quality assurance project plans, those famous QAPs, and help them better communicate with the regulator and with the folks that they hired to do the work in the field. So, again, that's coming soon, and also leveraging contracts for innovative site characterization and cleanup, contacting Primer and Administrative Toolkit. Again, this Primer is... This will be about the third version of this document that's also been one of the most commonly downloaded from CLUIN and from the BTSC. Expect to see that coming up soon. And we appreciate the input that we're receiving from many folks in the interim. So if we could go to slide number 45. As usual, the feedback form is extremely appreciated, and often that information gets used not only to improve webinars, but also to help us see where what the kinds of issues our audiences are struggling with, to help improve other resources we produce. So that's much appreciated. We got the message loud and clear that the audio did not work on this webinar. We truly regret that, and took action to improve it here. And as I said, we will be using new technologies going forward. So with that, thank the speakers again, Megan, Ignacio, Dan, thank you very much for being here, and all of you for participating on the phone lines and on the Internet. Let me ask a final chance for any questions while we still have the speakers online. Okay, then we will post the audio portion of this in about a week, and you can receive it in the space. Again, thank you very much. Appreciate your participation. Goodbye.